Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Today, joining me is Patrick McFarlane of the Liberty Weekly podcast. Patrick, where is the best place to find your collection of intellectual contributions to the Liberty movement?
So the best place to find me is at libertyweekly.net. Otherwise, you can find me at libertarianinstitute.org/Patrick.
I invited Patrick on, firstly, to give us a guest speakership in constitutional law. There's a great paper written in 1995 by John Hasnis, published in the Wisconsin Law Review, or 95, whenever it was written. And I think it gives us some great intellectual insight about law. So I wanted an attorney to come on and walk us through the very first concept that Hasnis go through. Patrick, if you could share your screen, please, for the viewing audience, and just walk us through this first intellectual exercise that Hasnis puts us through. This is a professor of law at Georgetown University. Now, he works with Jason Brennan. So I am going to mute myself. And Patrick, you are free to go.
Yeah, so fundamentally, the myth of the rule of law presents a concept that you really should learn in your first year of law school. And it's not very widely taught, but it's something that should be demonstrated to you, something that you should realize throughout some of your first courses. And so the way that John Hasnis presents this is that he has the reader answer some questions in a very short quiz. So he says, stop. Before reading this article, please take the following quiz. The First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States states, in part, quote, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Now, on the basis of your personal understanding, this is very important, on the basis of your personal understanding of the meaning of this sentence, not of your knowledge of constitutional law, please indicate whether you believe the following sentences to be true or false. So the first question, in time of war, a federal statute may be passed prohibiting citizens from revealing military secrets to the enemy. Now, keep in mind, as I'm reading these, keep in mind what the First Amendment states. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. So again, in time of war, does this mean a federal statute may be passed prohibiting citizens from revealing military secrets to the enemy? Question two, the president can issue an executive order prohibiting public criticism of his administration. True or false? Question three, Congress may pass a law prohibiting museums from exhibiting photographs and paintings depicting homosexual activity. True or false? Question four, a federal statute can be passed prohibiting a citizen from falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater. True or false? Congress may pass a law prohibiting dancing to rock and roll music. True or false? Question six, the Internal Revenue Service may issue a regulation prohibiting the publication of a book explaining how to cheat on your taxes and get away with it. True or false? Question seven, Congress may pass a statute prohibiting flag burning. True or false? Then he says, thank you, you may now read on. However, he doesn't address this, but every single one of those questions deals with a Supreme Court case that actually came before the bench. And so these fact patterns are not fact patterns that he's actually making up. So the great lesson that he's trying to illustrate here is something that I mentioned before that you learn in one of your first years of law school. And in his paper, he gives an example about maybe your first year constitutional law class, and you're discussing one of your first cases, and the professor asks you a hypothetical question. And the example that John Hasnis gives, there are two students, and each student gives a different answer, but each student is able to back up their answer with well-reasoned precedent from case law, and is able to interpret the facts in a way that supports their conclusion and their position. And the big lesson is that, you know, who is right? Who is right of those two students that both give different answers to the same question posed by the professor? The answer is that they're both right, even if their viewpoints are diametrically opposed. And the thing that John Hazness is trying to illustrate is that there is no objective correct answer in the law. And I actually have a standing joke with my in-laws, because they will, someone will pose a question, a legal question to me, because I'm the lawyer in the family. And my answer is always, it depends. And when you say it depends, it's because, well, there is no correct answer. It really depends on what the facts are and who is arguing the facts and what precedent that they're relying on. So down at the bottom, John Hazness sums this answer up succinctly. He says, doublethink, as proposed in Orwell's 1984, is to hold simultaneously two opinions which canceled out, knowing them to be contradictory and believing in both of them. He says, this doublethink, however, in no way prevents people from simultaneously regarding the law as a body of definite, politically neutral rules that are amenable to an impartial application which all citizens have a moral obligation to obey. Because people in their mind, the average person, has this idea that laws are just, that if laws are unjust, they shouldn't be a law. Now, this takes for granted the fact that the law is something that is above everyone, that it's objective, that it has an application that is consistent in all aspects, that whatever the word of the law is, that is what the result will be, and that the statute governs what the outcome is. And that simply is not true. And it's very easy to demonstrate that. And a lot of people will know this just from their basic experience if you've ever actually interacted with the law or been a part of a court case or any kind of procedure like that. So that is the general rule that John Hazness illustrates in The Myth of the Rule of Law.
All right, with that understanding of the myth of the rule of law, let's get into the Socialist Constitution of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. This is the North Korean Constitution. Now, it might seem like, well, this is low-hanging fruit criticizing the government of North Korea. The point is that it's so easy to think of people in what we regard as totalitarian societies as total idiots who believe in some leader for no reason. They're just so delusional. I could never fall for any of that. All they are is either hateful or ignorant. Well, there actually is a science to getting 20 plus million people to blindly obey your arbitrary edicts. So it's important to learn how this comes about. And I figured one of the best ways to do that is focus on the first 22 articles of their constitution. The whole constitution is like 195. It's just no time. 27 pages, small print. So Patrick McFarlane, the attorney, and I are going to go through all of these, starting with Chapter 1 of the Constitution, the political realm. Article 1 says, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is an independent socialist state representing the interests of all the Korean people. Patrick, what are your thoughts on Article 1?
Well, when you first start out and you try to create a constitution, most founding documents try to say where the government derives its power. It's this idea of sovereignty. It's the concept of the ultimate political power where it resides in a country. And the preamble of the North Korean Constitution talks a lot about the great leaders, and that's where the power comes from. And so in the first article, they're talking about what kind of government that they're creating and what is the purpose of the government. And right out there, I think this kind of reflects this idea of like a socialist state where it's collectivist, essentially, is what it is. Is it's representing all of the Korean people. Now, funny enough, the United States Constitution also refers to the power coming from the people, we the people. So it's a little bit of a parallel there. I mean, you use it for two different ends. The end result is different, but or at least ostensibly it's supposed to be different. But it says right there it's developing an independent socialist state, and it's supposed to be representing all the interests of all the Korean people. Does it do that? What do you think?
That would be pretty difficult. It's hard enough to know what's in the interest of myself in the short run and the long run, let alone me and a neighbor, or me and my community, or me and 20 million strangers. I think that's pretty unlikely. Read Article 2 for us.
So Article 2 says the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is a revolutionary state which has inherited the brilliant traditions formed during the glorious revolutionary struggle against the imperialist aggressors and in the struggle to achieve the liberation of the homeland and the freedom and well-being of the people. And just right off the bat, this is something I noticed in the rest of the document, is this idea of revolution and something that is akin to socialist or communist countries that aspire to that state, is that it's about recreating traditions in a revolutionary struggle against an oppressor, but recreating traditions meaning reinventing the what it is to be human, reinventing the man, like the new socialist man.
Anytime struggle is mentioned, you're sort of signaling to people, we have this common enemy in relation to one another. This is what binds us, is this struggle against the bourgeoisie, the imperialist aggressors, who they mainly say in the works of Kim Il-sung, they'll say the Japanese imperialists. They'll also frequently mention the American imperialists, and the idea of liberation, of course, assuming that liberation means you no longer have the right to freely contract with people. Either way, notice how the word struggle and liberation are used to pull at your heartstrings without ever giving you an explicit explanation of what these things mean. They later go on to explain what services you'd be entitled to. When it comes to the concept of imperialism, well, of course, it's no different Washington, D.C., enforcing its views on Arizona than Britain imposing its views on Nigeria or Ghana or the Ivory Coast. It really is unbelievable how they can, how states are able to criticize other governments for exactly what they're doing. Most recently, China came out and said, the U.S. killing civilians under the name of democracy will no longer be tolerated. And at first, it's like, well, what are you going to say? Of course, second, the Communist Party of Chairman Mao, did they kill anyone in the struggle against Ishek, or was that just a peaceful transition of power? Of course not. Just as it's imperialist for China to control Taiwan, Washington, D.C., controlling Arizona, it's just as imperialist for Kim Jong-un or Kim Il-sung to violently dominate the average Korean citizen. As Rothbard greatly points out, that you can always have this principle of secession until you get down to the individual. Why shouldn't we have a world government? America should secede? Well, then certainly Arizona should be able to secede. And then, well, Phoenix should be able to secede. And then you get down to the individual level. My final comment on this, and this is the longest I'll go on any of them, is this concept of tradition, something that I think we might overlook. Here is Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson on tradition. It is, however, a sophomoric error to claim that tradition is merely a sentimental attachment, though this is precisely what mainstream social science holds. Tradition, rather, concerns itself with moral and social stability, in that the rationality of the ages is crystallized and reduced to the level of the masses for their internalization. In short, the internalization of moral ideas through tradition is the only way a moral life can be led by anyone, both for the sake of communal solidarity, as well as the simple fact that an ordinary human being cannot be expected to commit a rational and logical ethical analysis for each and every moral decision. Certainly, one notes, the academic is little different. Therein lies the importance of tradition for the masses, something I think libertarians, including myself, absolutely need to appreciate a lot more. Going on to Article 3, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is guided in its building and activities only by the great Kim Il-sungianism and Kim Jong-ilism. This is a concept called Juche, J-U-C-H-E, the state ideology of North Korea, known as Sungian Marxism. Patrick, any comments on Article 3 before going into Article 4?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's kind of a comment on John Hasnis's article. Is you see the red letter of the law here on the articles, but those things, you know, they're contradictory. And if you take it textually and just read it by its regular definition, then all of their legal issues should be pretty clear cut, right? I mean, like the Constitution of the United States, about, you know, free speech, the First Amendment. It should be pretty clear, the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. And at least, you know, some of those things in the U.S. Constitution, they don't outwardly contradict each other per se. I'm sure you could find some contradictions in the U.S. Constitution. But here, I mean, you try and secure some things, but at the same time, the DPRK is guided in its building and activities only by the great Kim Il-sungism, Kim Jong-ilism. And so that contradicts pretty much everything else, because they can just, at their own whim, completely rewrite the Constitution. It would seem Article 3 allows that. So just by its own diction.
One quick thing before going into Article 4. Notice that by the third article of, what are there, like 195 in this altogether, they're already mentioning people by name. Like, if you're mentioning a constitution, I would think that you'd want it to be as sort of impersonal as possible. This, I don't think is Washington or Jefferson or George Mason mentioned in any of the American articles. One of the important things is for people to have heroes that they admire, so you can constantly reference these heroes and pull at the heartstrings of the masses. You know, it was Winston Churchill who once said blank. Whatever comes after that, you almost have to believe. I mean, the man who defeated National Socialism. I believe it was Lincoln's view that we should, whatever comes after that. Again, you got to blindly believe. MLK, Rosa Parks. These are people who, if you already admire, using one of their sentences and construing it in any way that you possibly can, will pull at people's heartstrings in such a way that if you just made an argument, it would never do. I mean, it's probably more effective to say, you know, Churchill would have wanted X, rather than, you know, let me cite Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. Let me read the following 20 pages. If you just say Churchill said, that's going to grab people's attention and grab at their heartstrings much more than any logical argument. So, of course, in Article 3, it makes sense for them to mention both the father and his first son in the Constitution. Sorry to interrupt you. Please, anything else on 3, and then go into 4, please.
No, they kind of dovetail off of each other, because Article 4 directly contradicts Article 3, in my view. The sovereignty, and we discussed this already, the ultimate expression of where a political power resides in a given country is, here it says, of the DPRK, resides in the workers, peasants, soldiers, intellectuals, and all other working people. The working people exercise state power through their representative organs, the Supreme People's Assembly and local people's assemblies at all levels. So if the ultimate sovereignty in the country lies with the working people, then it can't lie with Kim Il-sung or anyone else. And I mean, in the Western tradition, it really, we have this concept of like the Magna Carta being one of the first expressions of the sovereignty not being absolutely with the monarch. And you have, in like, at least in the Western tradition, you have gradually, it goes from the king to the king when he sits with the court, and then to the parliament, And then in the United States, popular sovereignty with the people ultimately. So this seems like a kind of a reflection of it, but in its ultimate expression, you would think that the sovereignty would lie with the people, which sounds like the U.S. Constitution. But we know, again, John Hasness, that's not exactly what that means, what the interpretation of it, because there is no objective interpretation.
So the line is workers, peasants, soldiers, intellectuals, and all other working people. First of all, I know intellectuals, they're the furthest thing from working you could think of. Whatever. I'll let that slide. But when you say all other working people, so children don't matter, or old people who are retired don't matter, the disabled don't matter, who are unable to work. Isn't this supposed to be the ideology of humanitarianism and caring for the downtrodden? See, under libertarianism, anything that those groups, children, the disabled, the elderly, if they've contracted with someone, they have a right to access resources, or if people form mutual aid societies, or if people care for their families, there's nothing wrong with caring for these people. But if I have, say, a disabled grandmother, and I go to work at the mine, and I come back and I give disabled grandma some of my money to buy her food, isn't she then exploiting my labor? So working people is not only a false divide, it's not even a productive one. The goal, of course, is obviously most people consider themselves working. So how do you, gain legitimacy among the public? Say I represent the working masses. Whom I consider myself working. In America, the scam is we need to lift the middle class wages and whatever. Why the middle? Why not the poor? And why poor Americans? Why not poor Haitians? Are you a xenophobe? Xenophobia is evil. Why are national boundaries any different than racial boundaries? Of course, it's all fake. When it comes to representative organs, I guess voting for someone is a way to represent them. A much better way of representation is allowing people to opt out of funding or associating the nonsense you're trying to push them into. So if you care about representing people, obviously anarcho-capitalism is the way to go. Article 5, all state organs in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea are formed and function on the principle of democratic centralism, which is defined as a process in which political decisions reached by voting processes are binding upon all members of the political party. Patrick, comments on Article Number 5?
Only to bring in Article Number 6, because again, I think it directly contradicts Article 5 and Article 4. The organs of state power at all levels, from the county People's Assembly to the Supreme People's Assembly, are elected on the principle of universal, equal, and direct suffrage by secret ballot. So unless I'm misinterpreting this, that doesn't describe a system of representative democracy, does it? It sounds to me like one man, one vote. So in that instance, is that everyone, like every single piece of legislation is passed by universal vote? Because, they obviously have an assembly. So are people voting for their representatives who then vote on laws?
I know. The system is that ignorant, immoral, lazy people get as much of an influence as intelligent, immoral, ambitious people. That's a real great system. Thanks. Thanks so much for the revolutionary struggle. Article 7. I'm sorry, what?
Three wolves and one sheep voting on what's for dinner, basically.
I know. Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein voting on what to do with the girl who's walking past them. Yeah, that seems legitimate. Thanks so much. Really fighting for the workers out there, not giving the workers opportunity to opt out. Centralism. Does that sound very worker-friendly? The average worker wanting to have to succumb to a ton of other opinions he doesn't consent to. Article 7, deputies to the organs of state power at all levels have close ties with their constituents and are accountable to them for their work. The electors may recall at any time the deputies they have elected if the latter lose the trust of the former. So close ties with their constituents is important, because this is the scam that FDR pulled in order to make the executive branch so powerful from 1933 to 44 when he passed away. The way you do that is by extending people at your employ into areas where you're not as directly influential. So how do I spy on the CIA? Offer assistance to all Central Intelligence employees with this new branch of people that I have erected. So they're just going in and they're checking in and they're regulating them and making sure everything's on the up and up. That is a way of getting people to be controlled in a way that otherwise would be virtually impossible. How's this one guy, Kim Jong-un, today in a building going to impose his will on people 1,000 miles away, or I don't know how big Korea is, hundreds of miles away, who don't have like a smartphone to check the updates as to what Kim Jong-un is up to? Well, by having close ties with their constituents, the constituents report to the local deputy. The local deputy reports to the county. County reports to the dictator, Kim Il-sung. That's how you're able to get an eye in the sky and to have eyes everywhere in a regime is under the guise of saying, I just want to make sure you guys are close, when really it's the deputies being spies on the constituents. Patrick, any comment on Article 7 before going into Article 8?
No, let's go into number 8. I'll read it?
Please.
The social system of the DPRK is a people-centered system under which the working people are the masters of everything, and everything in society serves them. The state shall defend the interests of the workers, peasants, soldiers, intellectuals, and all other working people who have been freed from exploitation and oppression and become the masters of the state and society, and respect and protect human rights. So what does that mean in practice, Keith?
Freed from exploitation? I guess this means that the Marxist form of exploitation is when one owner benefits from the employ of another. This literally means all wives who stay at home and spend money that their husbands earn, that they're exploiting them, and marriage should be outlawed. Internships should be illegal because you don't get money. Universities should be illegal because you don't get paid for the work you do. Schools should be illegal because they're making you work for $0 and 0 cents. This, of course, is volunteer work needs to be outlawed because you're not getting paid. So you're being exploited. Someone's using your labor and you're being compensated $0. So like, I guess like giving blood is like the most exploitative thing humanly possible. It's a body resource you're giving away for $0. That's like the ultimate evil in the Marxist regime, which of course under libertarianism is something to be applauded, a voluntary life-changing exchange. Anything else on 8 before I go into 9?
And of course, the unspoken thing and the thing that we're heavily implying is that when someone comes in and prevents me from going to school or prevents me from giving blood, well, that's not exploitation. That's just, you know, someone looking out for your best interests, right?
Exactly. Someone who offers me nothing is a proletariat and a comrade. Someone offering me products, services, and a job and a house, evil exploitator. God, I wish there was more evil exploitation in the world. Article 9. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea shall strive to achieve the complete victory of socialism in the northern half of Korea by strengthening the people's power and vigorously performing the three revolutions, ideological, technological, and cultural, and reunify the country on the principle of independence, peaceful reunification, and great national unity. Please comment on 9. There's just so much there. Three revolutions. That's quite the big order.
Yeah. Well, again, it's what we touched on before, is that the socialist struggle is recreating things as they are in a state of nature. Whereas we as libertarian anarcho-capitalists, I think that we have a tendency to prefer people as they are, that we don't have to recreate people because of that, the anarchy of production, for instance. Or maybe this is not quite as in vogue, but I guess you could make an argument that traditionalism is trying to preserve the status quo in the way that I guess you could argue that it is the natural state. So I support, you know, things being in their natural state, free of undue influence, of course, free of a revolution to recreate things in a new image. I prefer the natural order is something that I would prefer as a libertarian. But furthermore, reunifying the country on the principle of peaceful reunification and great national unity. Yes.
Article 10, read it for us, please.
The DPRK's, hold on a sec, underpinned by the ideological unity of all the people based on the worker-peasant alliance led by the working class. The state shall revolutionize all the members of society and assimilate them to the working class by intensifying the ideological revolution, and shall turn the whole of society into a collective united in a comradely way, or else.
You guys have such nerve calling us utopians who just live in this ideological realm, which even by these people, of course, the libertarians are called when simply we just want the state to be held to the same standards as any other person or organization. When they say there's going to be ideological unity between the workers of the world. Remember, Kim Il-sungism is specifically Sungianism for Marxism. Workers of the world unite. Billions of people are going to be on the same page about something. That is so ridiculous. Has someone in the same class ever, like, had a fight about anything? Have they ever gotten to a fist fight? Have two people in the same class ever murdered each other? Has anyone in the same economic class ever raped another person in the same economic class or been rude to them? I don't know. Has anyone in the same economic class gotten into a marriage and then divorced someone who came from the same class as them? Like, they have irreconcilable differences. They're willing to go through a divorce. This concept of the class struggle and class consciousness just allows them to say this is the science. This is the class consciousness. Anyone who deviates from this is an enemy, which, of course, we see today in 100 million different ways. When you and I were younger, it was anyone who doesn't agree with this, you're either with us or with the terrorist. You're either with us or you're with COVID. You're either with the workers or you're with the bourgeoisie who should be put against the wall. So it's partially pulling at your heartstrings. And another, like a vague threat. Comments on that?
No, I don't think so. But Article 11 goes on and says the DPRK shall conduct all activities under the leadership of the Workers' Party of Korea. So, I mean, you get one choice, essentially.
You see, Patrick, the free market's really bad because there might be monopolies and there might be oligopolies. Also, unrelated, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea shall conduct all activities under the leadership of the Workers' Party of Korea. Every single thing they cry about the voluntary sector applies to them tenfold. Article 12, the state shall adhere to the class line and strengthen the dictatorship of the people's democracy so as to firmly defend the people's power and socialist system against all subversive acts to hostile elements at home and abroad. Thoughts on Article 12?
It's interesting to see, you know, they say the dictatorship of the people's democracy, of course, in the vision of Kim Il-sungism. Is that according to Article 4 or Article 3?
One of the earlier ones. Wow. Yeah. I'm thankful that I wonder what the translation is from the word dictatorship into Korean, just because it's a little shocking. The concept of the dictatorship of the proletariat has sort of been ditched in the later years after the Soviet Union. But this this looks like it's up to date. I guess any concept of people feeling that their ideas, so long as they're at the front, they should be dictated. Well, even if they are your ideas, you're putting so much power in the hands of a small group who have no incentive to please you. If they do a good job, well, maybe. But if they do a bad job, well, then they end up getting more money and they don't face any punishment. So I think anyone should be afraid of a dictatorship. Like, the greatest thing that the right has had in America has been Donald Trump, who pushed red flag laws, who said that he'd like to take the guns first and then do due process, recently bragged about the booster shot, said he would have taken out Fauci, but it would have been a headache from the left. Trump drastically increased spending, but he couldn't even build a wall on the border of a country that already exists. At least dictators in the past, like, expanded their empires. Trump couldn't build a wall. I mean, don't tell me that you think there's going to be this dictator who's going to call you on the phone on a daily basis. Hey, what should I do? Even if your dictator gets in power, they have no incentive to please you. Patrick, final thoughts and Article 13, please.
So the other thing about it is how we say war is the health of the state. And Randolph Bourne, that's a quotation from Randolph Bourne, but I think it's exactly true, because you look at this and look at a totalitarian system, and they define things as being a permanent revolution, and they define their very existence and justify that existence as defending the people's power and socialist system against all subversive acts of hostile elements at home and abroad. So again, none of this really is to say that the United States system is much better or preferable. Well, it is preferable the way it played out. But these elements all exist in the United States system. I guess it's just much easier in this system, because they say, I mean, they're outwardly at war. Their defining document defines them as being at war.
So one question that I have for an attorney, this was Antonin Scalia's general point about what makes America great. And his point is that what makes America great is the checks and balances. He references Alexander Hamilton, that needing permission of both the Senate and the House and the executive will be extremely difficult to pass legislation. However, considering that our current shortcoming is too much legislation, this is a small issue overall. So Scalia even went as far as to say the Soviet Union almost has a better constitution than us in a lot of places. But the reason that we have a better country is we recognize the legitimacy of a division of powers and a check and balance on the executive. As an attorney, how do you analyze a statement like that?
Well, and maybe I should walk back a little bit of what I said, because obviously I would much rather live under the United States system than the People's Democratic Republic of Korea, the DPRK. It is important to have separation of powers, but it's no less utopian than, I guess, it's much more utopian than wanting a libertarian, you know, anarcho-capitalist world, because in actuality, I think in effect what you get, and part of it is Hasnas's insight, but what you really get is a system that allows and accelerates the despotism. And I think the only thing that really holds it back is our belief that the system still achieves the separation of powers and decentralization, when it in fact doesn't. And I think we've slowly been getting rid of it. And I think the illusion is starting to fall by the wayside that we live under, again, like, the rule of law. But I think that the reality of the situation is kind of being laid bare.
And just one final thought on Article 12. You can see the same Republicans today who were previously saying, well, you know, it's vitally important that the government have the right to get the terrorists So, yeah, the NSA is totally legitimate, the FBI and whatever. Today, you have Steven Crowder, Glenn Beck, Dinesh D'Souza, big names in the right wing saying, look at what they did to the commander-in-chief. They faked Russian allegations against him that he was, you know, some Putin puppet. And after 2 years and millions of dollars, Mueller produced nothing. If they could do that to a president, what do you think they could do to, like, some random guy making 20, 40, 60 grand a year? They can totally take everything they can from him. And who are the subversive people now? Well, anyone with ties to the Proud Boys, and if you're a racist or a white supremacist. Joe Biden recently said, the biggest threat we have in terrorism is white supremacy. And of course, anytime anyone commits any action, even if it's a non-white person, it's because they live in a society controlled by white supremacy. So look, at any time you're going to be in support of something, imagine you on the opposite end, because you will be the second that it's politically convenient. Article 13. The state shall maintain the revolutionary work method of going among the masses to find solutions to problems by implementing the mass line, and of giving full play to the spiritual strength and creativity of the masses by giving precedence to political work, work with people. Patrick, thoughts on Article 13?
Well, this sounds really great, doesn't it? Going among the masses to find solutions to problems by implementing the mass line and of giving full play. So I mean, it's central planning. I mean, maintaining the revolutionary work method, again, that's maintaining the ever-present war. That's the continuous war, and turning it upon the people by having central planning bureaucrats go amongst them to find solutions to their problems.
You know, I think it's really greedy of this woman, Adele, to get so much attention. Shouldn't we have a method of going among the masses to find good singing voices? And how about that evil Francis Ford Coppola producing that movie, The Godfather? Shouldn't we go among the masses to find movies that the average person would make? Look, genius comes in many different forms. Sometimes it's in movie making or singing or coming up with, comedic jokes. What percentage of the people are as funny as Chris Rock or Jerry Seinfeld or Brian Regan? Something like 0.00001%. So in the same way, finding a solution of how to increase communication, say, having cell phones, having computers, no one can do what Steve Jobs can. Or when I say no one, I mean a microscopic amount of people. Or a microscopic amount of people can do what Elon Musk did, coming to America as an immigrant and becoming as wealthy as he has. Or Ayn Rand, being a refugee from the United Soviet Socialist Republic, coming to America to publish two of the greatest best-selling books of all time. So, no, you're not cool, you're not trendy, you're not equal if you say going among the masses, hey, everyone on the plane, let's vote on how the pilot should fly. No, it's all right if one person decides. Nothing there. Patrick, final thoughts on 13, and please read 14 for us.
14, the state shall determinedly conduct the Three Revolution Red Flag movement and other mass movements so as to accelerate the building of socialism to the max. Red flag movement. I got triggered.
I did too. I guess when I hear mass movements, the concept of constantly controlling people is extremely difficult. So if you can write yourself the blank check of, oh, we're just following the Constitution, we're just creating a mass movement, well, clearly that's your way of working within the populace to have an outcome that you'd like. How do you get a mass movement against any militia members? Well, didn't you hear about the, evil militia that tried to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer for no reason, this innocent woman? Well, That was actually the state. It was 12 FBI informants. Well, that is them justifying through Article 14 any mass movements. You have to get people to buy into your stuff before you sell it to them. So how do you get the FBI informants on board? You just refer to the Constitution. You're doing your constitutional duty. And then you threaten them with something else. So you're both getting the performers to perform the action of doing this fake kidnapping that that you're doing, and you're justifying it by referencing the Constitution. So people that would say, no, this sounds immoral, well, they've grown up to believe the Constitution is legitimate. So that is how you're able to, that is the value, rather, in conducting mass movements. Article 15, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea shall champion the democratic national rights of Koreans overseas and their rights recognized by international law as well as their interests. Thoughts on Article 15?
I just find it really interesting. I guess it goes along with the DPRK and their struggle against like colonial oppressors is the fact that they care about being recognized by international law, that I suppose maybe that's part of every nation that's trying part of every regime that needs international recognition. I don't know. I don't know if the Constitution put any kind of international recognition clause or anything like that in the Constitution. I know that now the Taliban government, one of the first things they did was bid for international recognition. But I just think it's funny why we would care about international recognition aside from like the consequentialist point of view, because if we don't get international recognition, then I guess other states won't want to do business with us. But do you do business with states or do you do business with individuals?
Do me a favor, read 16 and 17.
So 16, the DPRKs shall... Let's see, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK, shall guarantee the legal rights and interests of foreigners in its territory. 17 says, independence, peace, and friendship are the basic ideals of the foreign policy and the principles of the external activities of the DPRK. The state shall establish diplomatic as well as political, economic, and cultural relations with all friendly countries on the principles of complete equality, independence, mutual respect, non-interference in each other's affairs and mutual benefit. The state shall promote unity with people all over the world to defend their independence and resolutely support and encourage the struggles of all people who oppose all forms of aggression and interference and fight for their country's independence and national and class emancipation. Wow, that's a mouthful. Contradictory statements. So at the same time that they promote non-interference, they're also talking about unity across the world for people who defend their independence and defend and encourage the struggles of all people who oppose all forms of aggression and interference. I mean, again, John Hasnes, The Myth of the Rule of Law, these libertarians talk about non-interventionism all the time. At the same time that we're criticizing the DPRK and we definitely feel sorry for the people who live under their regime, I would not support their efforts to overthrow the DPRK or to fight against it. But at the same time, you know, here in this paragraph, the DPRK is talking about, you know, it's the same thing the United States has, talking about preserving individual liberty and freedom with aggressing and interfering with other countries. So these are contradictory statements in this paragraph.
Of course, equality. So Kim Jong-un is pretty much equal to the other 20 million North Korean citizens. He can't do anything that they can't do. Sometimes they pass laws and he has to abide by them. And sometimes he passes laws that other people have to abide by. It's totally equal. There's no inequality. There's no inequality there. Independence, of course. If a million Koreans want to be independent from supporting the state, do they recognize that? Well, if independence is a value, surely they would recognize that as legitimate. Mutual respect. Is it respectful to not give someone the dignity that they have the freedom to disassociate with you if they don't want to march in your communist army parade? Is that legitimate if they want to trade with South Koreans or Americans or people in China or Japan without the state's consent? Is that respected non-interference? Of course, the joke just writes itself. Does the state interfere with the people? Of course. Can the people interfere with the state? No, that's evil terrorism and subverting the workers' paradise. All nonsense. Article 18, few more to go here. The law of the DPRK reflects the wishes and interests of the working people and is a basic instrument for state administration, respect for law, and strict adherence to and execution of it is the duty of all institutions, enterprises, organizations, and citizens. The state shall perfect the system of socialist law and promote the socialist law-abiding life. Patrick, thoughts on 18 before going into Chapter 2, The Economy?
Well, what is the socialist law-abiding life? I mean, John Hasnes put that forward. We already kind of went over that in part the beginning of this episode, so it's impossible to follow.
Please read the second section is Chapter 2, The Economy. Start us off with Article 19.
The DPRK relies on socialist relations of production and on the foundation of an independent national economy.
Yeah, socialist relations of production, I guess, would be the people owning the means of production. And if I owned them, I'd have the right to contract my labor for them, which means employers and the bourgeoisie are a legitimate institution, so far as they're arrived at through voluntary exchange and original appropriation. Again, we've already answered this this earlier. Any thoughts on 19?
Nope. 20, in the DPRK, the means of production are owned by the state and social cooperative organizations. So I thought that was interesting, Keith. I don't know what they're referring to by social cooperative organizations. Is that like a worker co-op, a privately owned worker co-op? I highly doubt it.
If you read the works of Kim Il-sung, it would be any organization that acts in the interest of the workers. So they totally take out who the actual owners are, and they attempt to prescribe intention to the people, which of course gives you a blank check, because if you're worried about the intentions, well, isn't everyone ultimately self-interested? Isn't that evil Henry Ford just wanting to make money? Isn't evil Andrew Carnegie just wanting to make money off steel, and the terrible Jeff Bezos trying to make money off books? Well, yeah, but in doing so, they make so many millions of strangers' lives better in doing so that it might as well say this is done in the interest of the customer, or done in the interest of employees. Of all the Walmart employees, aren't they benefiting? Aren't they getting an income and a steady job that they can build their future resume on? So isn't that benefiting them? So the concept of that it's owned by a certain group, and the ownership is guided by the intention to increase the well-being of a certain demographic, allows you to basically have anything fill in for that interest. It's in the interest of the worker. Well, whatever the worker's interests are can basically be unlimited, and you can prescribe to them more or less anything. Article 1 is again complementary to 20. The property of the state belongs to all the people. This one's longer, but I want to break this down just because this matters as far as intellectual property goes. When it comes to IP, let's say we take the book Man, Economy, and State that the Mises Institute allows you to download the PDF for free. If one person or 1 billion people download that book, the physical integrity of that book has not been diminished, assuming we're talking about, say, my copy, Man, Economy, and State with Power and Market. However, let's say we have an automobile. If I want to drive it from Las Vegas to San Diego, and Patrick wants to drive it from Las Vegas to Lincoln, Nebraska. We cannot both have these things. This is a conflict of interest, not just a difference. Whereas in the first case, it's a difference of interest. I want some people to have a copy, others want others. Either way, the physical integrity of my book has not been changed by people sharing the PDF with one person or a billion people. With this car, with tangible property to belong to all the people, is to more or less say the majority rule, and the majority by every metric are ignorant. So this isn't anything to brag about. This is worse than some people owning it and then providing it to others in mass or at a large scale through a profit incentive. Patrick, any thoughts on things belonging to everyone?
Later on in the Constitution, they talk about private property, and they actually define what private property is, and they allow private property. However, I think de facto, I talked about this earlier, natural order. De facto, you can outlaw private property as much as you want, but humans have evolved to have a concept of private property, or else everything falls apart and people die and starve in mass numbers. And I'm talking mass numbers larger than what they're currently starving and dying under in North Korea.
Article 21 continues, there is no limit to the property which the state can own. Again, I can't stress this enough. They constantly say the bourgeoisie has too much power in the hands of too few, while they want the government, the mass murdering psychos, to own literally everything and literally everyone. 21 continues, all natural resources, railways, air transit service, post and telecommunications establishment, as well as major factories and enterprises, ports and banks of the country are owned solely by the state. Monopoly, again. The state shall protect and develop on a preferential basis state property, which plays the leading role in the economic development of the country. Are there any other ones that you highlighted? That was the last one that I read through.
I think the last thing we should touch on is private property right there, Article 24. Private property is property owned and consumed by individual citizens. Private property is derived from socialist distribution according to work done and from supplementary benefits granted by the state and society. The products of individual sideline activities, including those from kitchen gardens, as well as income from other legal economic activities, also shall also be private property. The state shall protect private property and guarantee by law the right to inherit it. So what do we think about that, Keith?
It doesn't give us anything specific for us to base an ideology on. Either people have the right to contract their private property out, or they don't, or the state has an extra say in everything else. I guess I'd have to read that a number of times. It's owned and consumed by individual citizens. So all I have to do to rightly own something is to drastically increase my consumption or distribution. One of the things that Marxists will say is anything that you can't defend yourself, you can't have, you know, Bezos enforcing millions of contracts. That essentially is a state. So anything that you can't defend yourself is not really yours. Well, this, of course, again, as my previous answer leaves out children, the disabled, the elderly, even the weak. And of course, we're called evil social Darwinists who don't care about the downtrodden. Derived from socialist distribution according to work done. So again, I guess if you can't perform any work, you don't. Isn't that what they're always accusing us of? Capitalism is work or starve. Well, this is explicitly you get property according to work you do. Supplementary benefits granted by the state and society, products of individuals, sideline activities, including from those kitchen gardens as well as income. Why did they specify kitchen gardens of everything? As well as income from other legal economic activity. Why would they have to specify legal? Because either things are legal and the workers decide to do them, or they're illegal. Either way, it's the workers wanting to engage in the black market. Isn't this a workers' state? Isn't that a representation of what I, the worker, would like to engage in? Who are you, the state, to tell me what's legal and illegal? If I'm the worker, I call the shots. Shall also be private property. The state shall protect private property and guaranteed, of course. So they limit it to trivial nonsense and say that is protected. That's pretty much all I have on that.
Except for the kitchen gardens. And I think that point is very important because they have to allow people to grow their own food for their own consumption again, or else people will die in large numbers. So there has to be some protection for, you know, individual consumption of food, or else, you know, the supply chain issues and the rationing leads to mass starvation.
Thank you to everyone for sticking with us for more than or close to 90 minutes here. For watching Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Patrick, brother, thank you for your time as always.
Yeah, thank you.